For today, we're still on handout number 5. And if you look at the new handout that I just handed out, it just kind of shows you where we are and where we're going. We're in Roman numeral 4b, the Alexandrian period. And you can kind of see where we're headed. We'll finish the historical summary, then we'll take a pause and look at some of the developments in Judaism up to that point. Then we'll get back into some history up through the Roman period, and then we'll look at the literature and then the religious and cultural developments leading up to the New Testament context. So that's kind of where we're headed. And we're switching back over then to handout number 5. We had just moved into the Alexandrian period. If you recall, we read the section in Daniel that speaks of the coming of a great king from Greece, and that was Alexander the Great. And we talked a little bit last time about his character and where he came from. And basically, we had gotten to the point where Alexander was now pushing east towards Syria, sort of retracing the route that the Persians had taken when they pushed west towards Greece. And we had just gotten to the part where Alexander had really dealt an important blow to Darius III at the Battle of Issus in Syria. I was looking at Bill's atlas yesterday, and if you look at an atlas or a map, there's a ridge of mountains that run sort of from that corner of the Mediterranean there at way north of Israel and into Syria, right where the water is there. There's a mountain ridge that runs northeast, and it's very difficult to get through there. There's only a few passes to get through. And that's where Alexander met and defeated Darius at the Battle of Issus at the so-called Sicilian Gate, which is a narrow mountain pass. Darius was allowed to escape, but his entire family was taken hostage. And then what Alexander did is rather than pursue him back towards Persia, he stopped and decided to go down into Palestine. And so that's where we are today. We'll look at what Alexander's conquest of Palestine. So the first thing he did is he besieged the city of Tyre. You remember where Tyre is on a map. It's right up on the seacoast, and it was actually an island fortress. You might remember from some of the other events in the Bible. It was a very strong fortification that was one of the leading trade centers in the Middle East at that point in time. It was a naval sort of community. It was very difficult to conquer because it was out in the water. So Alexander besieged it for 7 months, so a very long siege, and he actually built a causeway from the mainland over to the island fortress, and a half a mile, to put it in perspective. He basically filled in the water for a half a mile and to take the island fortress. And it did fall after 7 months. That was a major conquest. You might recall from some of the prophecies in Ezekiel that there is a doom prophesied for Tyre that was partially fulfilled during the Babylonian period, but it was really fulfilled here in Alexander's time when it was fully conquered. Going southward from there, most of Palestine surrendered peacefully to Alexander, similar to what the towns had done when he was moving through Asia Minor. A lot of them just opened their gates to him. The Samaritans, in particular, went quickly over to Alexander, and while he was besieging Tyre, they provided 7,000 troops to help him. That's just another thing to remember in the Samaritan-Jew differences. That'll come up later. But the Samaritans immediately helped them by sending troops. And then, according to Josephus, Alexander then granted them permission to build a temple on Mount Gerizim, and that's in the heart of Samaria. So there was sort of a rival temple set up by the Samaritans on Mount Gerizim. And there's a whole story in history about how that happened and the priesthood and all that that I'm going to skip over. But there was a rival temple there. And the Samaritans kind of ruined it for themselves later, because after this sort of happened a few years later, after Alexander conquered and then moved further to the east, he left a governor in place. Andromachus was the man's name. And the Samaritans assassinated him and basically resulted in having the punishment of their city was turned into a Macedonian military colony after that. So they kind of fell out of favor by assassinating the governor of Alexander. And anyways, he continued to move south, and then he came to Gaza, which is, you know where the Gaza Strip is, where there's a lot of trouble nowadays, the Philistine territory from biblical times. He captured Gaza after a two-month siege. Now we're about 332 BC, if you're keeping track. And he resettled it with Macedonians, establishing it as the first Greek city in Palestine. So that was kind of an important event, too. Now, it was at this point in the narrative of Josephus that Alexander came to Jerusalem. This is kind of an interesting story, so it might be worth telling briefly. The Jews had not been so eager to help Alexander when the Samaritans provided troops. The Jews did not provide troops to help Alexander in his conquest. And that was because they were loyal to the Persian rulers that they had been associated with. And so they said, we're going to remain loyal to the Persians until, you know, I guess until they're not in power anymore. And so Alexander wasn't too happy about that. And Josephus records an account where Alexander came to Jerusalem. This is probably legendary. We're not quite sure if it actually happened or not. There's a lot of debate on whether Alexander would have taken the time to go to Jerusalem at this particular time when he was pushing towards Egypt. But at any rate, there was probably some kind of interaction between Alexander and the Jews at this point in time. But I'll just tell you how the story goes. The story goes that Alexander was coming towards Jerusalem after he took Gaza. And he was coming basically to destroy something because they hadn't helped him. And the Jews knew that he was coming, didn't really know what to do. So the high priest at the time, Jaddua, they came out of the city with a large retinue, all of the priests dressed in their robes, their white robes, and they came out to meet Alexander on the road. And the story goes that Alexander came up to the priest and bowed down before him and basically paid him honor. And all of Alexander's military leaders who were with him were thinking, what's going on here? Why aren't we just slaughtering these people and taking their city? And Alexander says, I had the dream that I saw this very man, and I don't remember how much earlier he had had this dream, but a long time before he had had a dream, and he saw this exact scene, apparently. And so he recognized it. So anyways, the story goes that he went into the town of Jerusalem with the high priest, actually offered a sacrifice to the Lord, and in Josephus' account, he was actually shown the prophecy from Daniel. Remember, there's a prophecy about Alexander in Daniel. And so he was shown the prophecy and was pleased to see the prophecy relating to his conquest. Remember, the goat with the great horn, who was the first king of Greece. It actually says that in Daniel. Whether any of this happened is up for speculation, but it's a neat story. It's a nice story to think that it happened. At any rate, there was no war with Jerusalem during Alexander's time, and it actually was a fairly peaceful time for the Jews while Alexander was in Palestine. He, of course, pushed down into northern Egypt, and when he came to Egypt, he was welcomed as a liberator, the great liberator of Egypt, and he was proclaimed a successor to the pharaohs. He was proclaimed a son of Amun-Ra, which is an Egyptian deity, and one of the very interesting things that he did in Egypt, of course, which had a long-lasting legacy, was he drew out the plans for a new city called Alexandria. And this was a big deal because Alexandria replaced Tyre as the great trading port on the Mediterranean. And, of course, it also became the cultural center of the ancient world, Alexandria, Egypt, and it's named after Alexander. I don't know if you ever figured that out, if you put some of these things together. It's named Alexandria because it was pretty much laid out by Alexander. Alexandria became famous for its museum and its library, and we'll talk about that in a future class when we get more to that. After that, Alexander did secure Egypt and Palestine, and he then pushed eastward. Remember, the Persian king Darius is still out there somewhere in Persia, and there's still some enmity there. So Alexander pushed eastward and defeated Darius decisively. And finally, at Gaugamela, which is in northern Babylon, if you can picture where that is, finally in 331 BC. This all happened pretty quickly, as you can see from the timeline. Darius actually wasn't killed there. He fled, and he fled basically further into Persia, but he was killed by his own forces as Alexander closed in on them. So that was the end of the Persian rule at that point in time. So then I've got this titled Final Days here. Alexander continued to drive his army east, and they actually went all the way to India. And they went up north, too, in that area of land. I think there is a map that I handed out. Do you have this M3 map? Did I hand that out? Yes, okay. If you look there, over to the right-hand side, the Indus River, you can see the border of India over there. And Alexander pushed all that way. Look at where that is relative to Greece over on the far left-hand side. And remember, he had covered that area in like 4 years, 3 years, something like that, defeating people along the way. And then he pushed northward up to the corner there of the map. He took all that area. If anybody's interested in reading that story, Plutarch's Lives has the chapter on Alexander, and it tells you the whole story of what happened there. It's really interesting reading. Well, his army mutinied at that point because he was still wanting to go, to keep going into India. And his army mutinied and said, we're not going any further. We're, you know, half the world away from our homeland. We're in the east where things are weird. And basically, we want to go home. So they stopped and they came back to Babylon, and you can see on your map there, Babylon's right in the center of the map. They returned back to Babylon, and Alexander became ill there in Babylon. He died 10 days later. So, just like that, he was done. This is 323 BC. He died at the age of 33 years old. He had basically conquered the entire Western and even part of the Eastern world in about 10 years, if you can put that in perspective. What happened after that, the disposition of his empire? It was left in a very fragile state because it had happened so fast. You can imagine that there wasn't a good unified governing structure in place yet, and there was also no clear successor to Alexander. He did not have any children at that point. He didn't have a son. The empire was divided up into territories which were ruled by satraps or governors, most of whom were military leaders of Alexander's. You'll often hear it said that it was divided up amongst his generals. Most of them had been military leaders. And it was loosely under the headship of Alexander's half-brother Philip until Alexander's infant son could grow up. His infant son had not actually been born when he died. He was born after he died. His half-brother, Philip, proved to be not very competent, though, and apparently that was pretty well known. So that didn't last very long, as we'll get to in a moment. So basically what happened is there was a power struggle that was waged between the camp that wanted to retain the unified Greek empire versus those who kind of wanted to set up their own kingdoms. And this is a very, very complex series of events that happened in kind of about a 10-year period. Lots of people involved, and I'm going to skip over all of that and just give you the highlights. But ultimately, what happened is Philip, his half-brother, Alexander's son, and his mother, Alexander's son's mother, that is Alexander's wife, Roxana, were executed by one of these fellows who was vying for control. So we're going to pick it up there because that leads off a very important period, which we're going to get to at the aftermath of Alexander's conquest. It's really the heart of the intertestamental period. But just to take a step back and reflect for a second on Alexander's policies and his influence. Well, we just saw that Alexander, he basically had conquered the entire known Western world in about 11 years. Most of which, think about it, to put it in perspective, most of the time he was in his 20s, and he was leading this amazing conquest. So he was a very young man. And he popularized this term that we'll hear a lot, Hellenization, which we're going to talk a lot about coming up shortly. But basically what that means is he had a strong desire to spread the Greek way of living to all of the nations that he was conquering. Everywhere he wanted to spread Greek culture. Hellenization comes from a root word, hellas, which means Greek, which is the Greek word for Greece. You might, if you have ever seen Greek coins or Greek stamps, it often says hellas or hella something on it, and that just means Greece. So he rapidly spread the Greek language, education, philosophy, religion, you know, the pantheon. He brought all of that with him because he was a firm believer that that was a better way to live. And remember, at this time, the Eastern, you know, Babylon and Persia and India were viewed as really primitive cultures from the Western point of view, from the Greek point of view. So he very much thought that he was bringing an improved way of life to them. He spread the common Greek. You've heard from, probably from New Testament studies, Koine Greek. He spread, which is common Greek, which helped to unify the diverse cultures around him. You know, it's a widespread area with a lot of cultures in there, different languages. But this was really the beginning of the spread of Greek into the Middle East here and into the Far East even. And during his conquest, Bill and I were talking about this a week or two ago, he carried a whole retinue with him of Greek people. So he carried with him historians, geographers, botanists. He was reputed to carry a copy of the Iliad with him and actually slept with it under his pillow, as the story goes. So this just shows you he was a firm believer in the Greek way of life. And he was very interested in studying history and geography and even botany, plant life, and things like that. Very interesting man. Yes, Bill. Right, yeah, we covered that back in his background that he had actually studied with Aristotle, right. No, but he had studied under Aristotle. His father had set that up. That's true. And that was probably a good, you know, one of the impetuses in his life for really embracing the Greek way of thinking. And remember, he wasn't technically Greek. They were from Macedonia, which at the time was not Greece. So it was interesting that he embraced the Greek culture and then spread it all over the world, all over the known world at that point in time. So his remarkable conquest and his personality led many nations to perceive him with a sense of awe. You know, like this young man who was bringing these new ways, you know, traveling and conquering so much so quickly. And that really opened the door for them accepting his ideas and his culture. That's why a lot of people opened their gates to him, not only in Asia Minor, but even in Palestine, for sure. So one of his characteristics was he allowed a large measure of religious freedom to the people that he had conquered. This, of course, helped with the goodwill that he engendered. But he allowed the conquered cultures to enjoy a measure of autonomy with the way that they practiced their religions. And I have a quote here, which may be in your handout. Oh, yeah, down there under E. This is by Viktor Cherikover, who is an expert in this period. Wherever Alexander appeared, he extended the rights of the natives, gave them a share in the government, and granted them the privilege of practicing their ancestral customs. So you can see there that he really engendered a sense of loyalty to the people that he had conquered because he involved them in the government and allowed them to basically live the way that they were used to living, with the exception of he was bringing the good parts of Greek culture into their way of living. There's very little recorded of his relations with the Palestinians, other than just the brief things that I mentioned. But we can imagine that the same freedom that he extended to other people would have been extended to the Jews in Palestine. So there was probably no encroachment on their way of worship or anything like that at this point in time. So Alexander, the last point I have there, E4, is that he embraced Eastern ways of living. This may seem a little bit contradictory to what I've been saying. It's a little bit of an interesting thing. He seems to have become somewhat infatuated with the Persian way of living and was interested in blending that Persian way of living with the Greek way of living. So you get this kind of interesting mixture of Hellenized Eastern way of living. So he retained a lot of the Persian forms of administration in the East. He elevated Persians to positions of responsibility. And that actually, I'm sure it engendered him to the Persians, but it actually started to build a big barrier between himself and his own people, because he wasn't placing his own people in charge. He was letting the Persians be in charge. So he began at this point, I think, to alienate his own people. And then he kind of remained in the East. You know, we just read how he came to his end, but he had really was planning to sort of settle in the East. He adopted forms and practices of an Eastern monarch. He took Persian dress, and he began demanding that people call him by the title of the Great King, which was a Persian way of being addressed. He adopted the Persian practice of receiving homage by prostration, so bowing down to him. So all of these things really began to alienate him from his own people. He encouraged the Greeks to intermarry with Eastern women, and he himself married a Persian princess, and that was Roxana, whom I mentioned before. And his adoption of Persian ways really led to this alienation among the Greeks and the Macedonians who were with him. And they began to kind of look at him as more Persian than Greek at this point, and particularly with the practice of prostration, which the Greeks saw as sort of a claim to divinity, and they were uncomfortable with that. So if you read some of the history about it, you can see that breach, and some of the people were very angry and went back, you know, basically went back to the West at this point in time. So there's a lot more I'm leaving out with his relations with his own people there, but that's kind of a summary of what was happening. So, but down to the summary point there under F, Alexander had truly changed the course of history in a single decade. It's a remarkable accomplishment. And his spread of Hellenism really went way beyond him. It long outlived him in the way that he brought the Greek culture and language to the Middle Eastern and the Far Eastern nations. And of course, the Jews are in the middle of this. They were not immune to the temptation of Hellenization, and they would be increasingly influenced by this cultural temptation and change over the coming centuries. And that's a big part of the tension that we're going to get to here that leads up to the Maccabean revolt. Alexander's bringing of the Greek culture, his Hellenization, really is setting the stage for a lot of the conflicts that are going to happen in the coming period of time, which is where we're going to get to next. So before we do that, are there any questions or comments about this period? Bill? Right. The question is, if there's a report that his mother may have sort of thought that he was from the gods, and did he start to believe it himself? I have no idea. He definitely seemed to, I mean, you have to read, you know, it's ancient history, and you're reading, you know, Plutarch is writing many years later, but he does seem to have kind of lost it at the end there. And I mean, in whether it's quest for fame, power, it's a remarkable, if you read it, I mean, and it sounds like you have, Bill, but if you read it, it's a remarkable story. His interactions with other people, like I mentioned before, he could be a tyrant to some people, but then humongously generous to other people, just giving them great riches and stuff. So on one hand, he didn't seem to care about any of that stuff. He just gave it away, you know. But on the other hand, it probably comes with the territory, right? Somebody who's that gifted and is going to be somewhat eccentric and is that driven, you know, there's always going to be a few of the, you know, you could see a little bit of a switch in temperament. You know, it might be somewhat expected for somebody that's driven that way and that has the ability to do the things that he did. It kind of probably comes with the territory a little bit. You know, a little bit of psychotic behavior. Maybe some egomania, too. It's a very interesting character, though. Yes, John. Well, Islam came much later, A.D. Yeah, centuries later. Well, at this point, it would be the Eastern religions, and it's quite a syncretistic mix. Zoroastrianism is one of them, and we think of the Magi following the star, you know, to Bethlehem. That's only one of them. There's three or four sort of major mixes. And you got to remember, too, this is a mix of people groups, right? Because we've got the Syrians, got the Palestinians, you've got the Egyptians who had their own mythology of the gods and everything as we know. And then you've got the Babylonians, or right in the middle here, then the Persians, and then further to the east, India. So that's a big mix of different religions. You know, the Babylonians had their own religions and gods and stuff as well. When you can ask that of any conqueror, right? Like, why did they try to do what they did? I mean, that's a question we ask of everyone who kind of goes and starts taking the world over. But in Alexander's case, I think at the early stages, it was a little bit of a revenge for the Persians having invaded Greece. So there was definitely an aspect of revenge. Now, after that, I think it was probably a mixture of a desire for conquest and power, a little bit of ego there, but also a lot of the sense that he was actually doing good by spreading the Greek culture to these what were regarded by the Greeks as primitive lands. So kind of probably just a mixture of all that, I would guess, you know. Right, right. Yes, Tom. Yeah, that goes back to the Persians, I think, though, invading, you know, the Western lands. I think there was a lot of, we're gonna go back, you know, we're going to push you back and push you back to Persia, so... We'll never know probably why. God only knows why he did what he did. Sort of a remarkable period in history, you know. This, to put it in perspective, you know, we just talked about the Persian Empire, which was, what, some 220 years or something like that. And we just covered a 10-year period. All of that happened in 10 years. It's really remarkable. Any other questions or comments before we move on? Okay. At that point, we are switching over. I think I have a new handout. So if you look at your big handout, we'll move into 4C, which is the Ptolemies and Seleucids. So this is really the period where all the action happened in Palestine. And I've got a new handout here that I'll grab for you. Handout number 6 is coming around. So we're done with handout 5. You might want to keep that map, though, M3. We'll be referring to that in a few minutes. Okay, well, those handouts are coming around. I'll introduce this period. So this is where all of the confusion comes in. Up till now, it's been pretty straightforward. The Persian Empire, Alexander's conquest. This is where it gets really kind of wild and kind of confusing. Very difficult to figure out exactly what happened. And I've spent a lot of my effort trying to figure this period out and try to summarize it in a way that's not completely confusing. This is the period where, you remember some of the writings in Daniel chapter 8 and then Daniel chapter 11 in particular. If you've read that, you realize how it's very confusing. There's all this stuff going on, these kings going back and forth and political intrigue. It's very difficult to sort out. And it's kind of weird, and it seems like it was even kind of hard to understand for Daniel because he seemed to be perplexed about a lot of this stuff that he was writing. So a lot of that is rooted in this period. So some of the sources that we'll draw on here are the book of Daniel. So one thing is, if you want to read something to sort of prepare, I would recommend reading Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11. And if you have a good study Bible, or a concordance or something like that that you could refer to, that would be good because it kind of explains some of the stuff that's happening there. Yes, Pastor. Pastor believes that there are sermons on those two chapters on the website also that can help you there. Chapter 11 is the worst. The ESV Study Bible, I keep plugging the ESV Study Bible because I've recently bought one, and I'm really impressed with the notes in the Study Bible. It's excellent. So there used to be one in the library if you want to check it out. get a good commentary too that can help you. But if you read through that, you'll be a little bit familiar with some of the stuff that we're talking about here in this period. First and Second Maccabees have information on this period, and Josephus is a primary source also in Book 12. I don't know if anybody's reading Josephus, but if you are, Book 12, chapters 1 through 5 cover this period. And then I've used some secondary sources, which I won't go over here. I have a bibliography if anyone's interested. Actually, in the ESV Study Bible, there's also a good timeline of the intertestamental events. It's either in the middle of it or in the back, I can't remember, but there's a good 2-page summary overview of the period that is helpful. One second source I will mention, I have this series, it's called The World History of the Jewish People in 6 volumes that I've had on my shelf this is another benefit of being the pastor's son and inheriting his library, but I have got a 6-volume set that's been sitting on my shelves probably for like 15 years. Well, I finally cracked it open, and it's excellent. It has, one of the volumes is on the Hellenistic Age, and that quote that I had from Victor Cherikover came from that book, and I've got some other things interspersed in here from that. It's written by generally liberal scholars who are experts on this area, and in some cases even, the one I'm reading now is on the Maccabean period, and it's written by a Jewish man from Israel. So it's very good, and I'll be referring to a few things from there. You'll probably, I don't even know if you can even get it anymore, but I'm relying on that somewhat as well. So, under A there, sparse information. There's very little information on Palestine during this period. So that's part of the confusion and part of the difficulty here. As I mentioned, there's very few historical sources. First and Second Maccabees focus on the revolt. So they don't really cover the period leading up to the revolt. And Josephus, you can see there, draws on scant resources that were available to him. One of those is this letter of Aristeas that we'll cover later. He kind of mixes in legendary material. So he's a good resource, but you have to read it with caution. And then really, there are incidental references in some of the other historians, some of the Greek and Roman historians, but they're not writing about Palestine. They're writing about world history, and every once in a while, they'll refer to something that relates to Palestine just incidentally, and we kind of glean some information from them. But all of that to say that there's really not a lot of historical sources here. I did mention the so-called Zenon papyri. This was an important discovery of papyri, or papyrus documents, that were found in Egypt during World War I. And what they were, you can see there on your outline, that they were the archives of Zenon, who was an agent of Apollonius, who was the minister of finance for Ptolemy II. And he was the king of Egypt at that time, the ruler of Egypt. So it's an interesting collection of lists, accounts, letters, contracts. It's sort of legal documents and records that were unearthed during World War I. And again, that's a lot of incidental references. Nothing directly, but a lot of information that shows us how business was conducted, what kind of contracts were in place during this period. So it really helps with that. And as I mentioned, the references in all of this information, the references to life in Palestine are sort of incidental to what they were really writing about and what their main purpose was. So the evidence is fragmentary, and so there's a significant amount of interpretation and reconstruction required to piece the puzzle together and to make a composite picture. This is particularly evident in the final days leading to the Maccabean revolt, and we'll get to that here shortly. But what it amounts to is, if you pick up a book on intertestamental history, most likely you will be presented with one version of what may have happened. And if that's the only book you read, you'll think that that's what happened. But then you pick up another book, and it'll have sort of a different spin on it. Different factors, different motivations, even different series of events that happen. And it's because the evidence is fragmentary and people are trying to piece it together. So kind of what I learned accidentally by looking at a lot of these secondary sources is a lot of them are recording the same time period, but they're coming at it from a different perspective. And what I've tried to do is pull out a summary that maybe is sort of a most likely scenario, but just keep in mind that a lot of it is trying to fill in the gaps. What I've done is a lot of work to try to bounce what people are saying against one another to come up with what a plausible sequence of events that led to, for instance, the abomination of desolation in the temple is a big thing that we'll get to. So I just want to put that out there so that you're aware of it. And I've gone back and done as much reading as I can in the primary sources, which isn't much, as you can see, to try to see why it is that people are coming to these different conclusions. And it's pretty obvious because there's a lot of holes and there's sometimes contradictions, like in Josephus. Sometimes he sort of contradicts himself in one writing versus another writing. We talked about that, you know, a long time ago when we covered Josephus. So just to make you aware that this is a tricky period to reconstruct, and we'll do our best here to go through it. So at this point, we want to buckle up and try to cover this period. To put it in perspective, we just covered a 10-year Alexandrian period. Now we're moving into the post-Alexandrian period, which is a period of about 150 years. And this 150 years is just filled with war, political intrigue, and a lot of strange stuff going on, and really revolving or using Palestine as a major traffic line of all this activity, because it's going to boil down to a conflict between the Egyptian kingdom and the Syrian kingdom. So I'm just kind of giving you that up front so you can see where we're coming from that way. In one sense, it's another version of the ancient Assyrian-Egyptian wars, warring power centers, the two power centers that you know from the Old Testament. Jerusalem was, again, the battleground between the Assyrians and the Egyptians for years, you know, for decades and decades. And then, of course, the Babylonians and the Egyptians then. So this is sort of just a renewal of that age-old conflict of those two power centers, with a different flavor now, because everything has been Hellenized now. So there's a Greek slant to everything that's happening now. You'll see this period referred to as the Greek period. In reality, none of these people are Greeks, but they're called Greeks because they've really been Hellenized, and there's a strong Greek and Macedonian influence in both of these ancient cultural centers. So we'll kind of see that as it unfolds here. We've got about 5 minutes, so I think I'm going to delve into it here. Does anybody have any questions or comments before we hit into the first points? Probably too confusing to ask any questions at this point. Okay, so we'll get started here for a few minutes at least, so set the stage. Alexander's empire, as I mentioned, was eventually divided up among his successors. And this is the beginning of what is called the Diadochen period. And this is from a Greek word which means successor. Diadochus means successor, and we've got here a division of his empire among his successors. So if you're reading like in Bill's atlas over there, he's looking at, it might be referred to as the Diadochen period. Okay, I'll just read a couple verses here from 1 Maccabees, which you remember we read this passage earlier. The beginning of 1 Maccabees speaks of Alexander in the first four verses, and then I'll read verses 5 through 9 here from 1 Maccabees. Remember, this is a historical book that was written during the intertestamental period. The time came when Alexander fell ill, and realizing that he was dying, he summoned his generals, nobles, who had been brought up with him from childhood, and divided his empire among them while he was yet alive. At his death, he had reigned for 12 years. His generals took over the government, each in his own province, and when Alexander died, they all assumed royal crowns, and for many years the succession passed to their descendants. They brought untold miseries on the world. That's the editorial comment by the writer of Maccabees. That's his view of it. So we'll get to the putting crowns on their heads here in a few moments. So there were four main immediate successors of Alexander, as pictured in the book of Daniel. And let me just read one verse from Daniel chapter 8, verse 22. This was in that section on the shaggy goat with the big horn, who's the king of Greece. I'll start in verse 21. The shaggy goat is the king of Greece, and the large horn between his eyes is the first king. Remember, that's Alexander, and Daniel had pictured how he had overcome the ram, which represented the kingdoms of Media and Persia. But in verse 22, it goes on to say, the four horns that replace the one that was broken off represent four kingdoms that will emerge from his nation, but will not have the same power. So see the idea of four kingdoms arising, that's the four images of the four horns. And one of the other prophecies in Daniel, I won't even guess, it might be the leopard. It talks about four heads, and that corresponds. If you remember the table I handed out a long time ago, it has that correspondence. But there's another reference to the four, the idea of four kingdoms growing out of Alexander's empire. And that's the period that we're entering here. So it's actually not easy to identify who the four rulers are, because it was a very fluid situation with much political and military maneuvering. As a result, if you read different commentaries, you'll find varying opinions as to who the four leaders are. And really what it depends on is if you take an early view or a later view, because there was a lot of fluidity. There were four strong rulers early, but later there were a different four rulers. And it just depends. We don't know exactly which four Daniel was referring to, if he was referring to the immediate division or a later division. So there was a complex power struggle that happened here, and five main rulers had emerged around 310 BC. Now, if you look at your map, M3, you can see these five rulers in the big, bold print, and you can see roughly where they were. You can't really see the areas on your copy. The one I have is in color. It's a little easier to see, but you can see where they are. It's the five rulers there. So over in Macedonia and Greece, the ruler was Antipater, and later his son Cassander. So you see Cassander over there on the left. Then in Thrace, which is southwest of the Black Sea right there, kind of in the left there, the ruler was Lysimachus, just above Cassander. So you can see they had relatively small areas. Then in Asia Minor and Palestine, Antigonus Monophthalmus, the one-eyed is what that means. Antigonus was the one right there in the center of Asia Minor. And then the two that really turn out later to be the ones that are battling are Seleucus over there in Persia, and Ptolemy in Egypt. And so you see I titled this section of the outline, the Ptolemies and Seleucids. That's the two rulers who are going to emerge and be battling over this entire period. But that map right there shows you the early division of his empire into those different camps.